Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff, with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store, but did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere, online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/BOF, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/BOF to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/BOF.
Hi, this is Imran Ahmed, founder and CEO of The Business of Fashion. Welcome to the BOF podcast. It's Friday, May 3rd. Stan Herman may be 95 years old, but the designer, activist, and former president of the Council of Fashion Designers of America remains an unstoppable force. His recent memoir, Uncross Your Legs, A Life in Fashion, details his journey through the American fashion industry, including bringing New York Fashion Week to Bryant Park. This week on the BOF podcast, I sit down with Stan to reflect on his incredible life and career and to talk about how the fashion industry has changed over the last few decades.
With so much money being floated out there, it's changed the whole nature of the business. Once we anointed designers as superstars, once big business and Wall Street put their cashmere gloves on, fashion is not the same.
Here's Stan Herman on the BOF podcast. Hello, Stan Herman. Welcome to the BOF podcast. It's a pleasure to have you join us. I am really looking forward to this conversation and examining what is, to say the least, a life very well lived.
I love that. That's very nice. I'll take that. I'll take it for breakfast and lunch and dinner. I like that.
Well, I wanted to start, Stan, with your early life. Can you just share a little bit about where you were born, how you grew up, the things that you were interested and curious in when you were a kid?
Yeah, it's a good place to be. In the book, I call it In the Beginning, and that's what it was. But I had a fairly usual upbringing, but I was what you call a depression baby. I was born in 1928. That's right in the heart of the Depression, into a Jewish family that were wondering what was happening in Europe at the time. My father became quite successful during the war years because he was in fabrics and he was a jobber and he knew how to do things that you shouldn't be doing to make money, black market stuff. So I lived a fairly privileged life. He had a beautiful silk store, which probably was the beginnings of my feelings about why I should do something in fashion. I fell in love in his silk store with all of the pattern ladies, Vogue and Advance and Simplicity and Butterick. His first son, I was his first son, was an achiever. I liked drawing, but at the same time, I was sort of butch in a way. I good baseball player, very competitive. I was on a seesaw, which was more interesting to me, sketching women's clothes or being first baseman on the local high school team. My mother unfortunately died when I was very young. I was 12 and she was only 36 years old. But in the writing of the book, it's amazing how much she became a part of my life again. I found things about her that I had never known, how she sewed, how she made patterns on the floor, how she knew how to cut a bias dress. We didn't have very much money at the time and she made lots of house dresses that she lived in. That's what she lived in. It's interesting also in my life today at 96, I'm on QVC in America and I make a fortune designing house dresses. So I would say that I had a good childhood in the war years where Jews were running, trying to get out of Europe. In fact, next week, for the first time in 70 years, because of the book, I'm meeting a cousin of mine who got out just at that time.
You're talking, of course, about World War II.
Absolutely. We're talking about the 40s. And some of the Hermans got out just at the very, very, very end. But then I can't remember when it was, but I remember saying to my father, I think I want to be a clothing designer.
And you don't know where that came from?
Well, it came from the silk store.
Yeah.
It came from the fact that I could measure fabrics. It came from the fact that it was the era of you could sew your own thing. Everybody sewed. Actually, my father had four stores. One was on the basement of Macy's. So it was like his little mini empire. And when I made that announcement, he wasn't surprised at all. In fact, he encouraged me to get a job. He got me a job at Vogue Pattern as a gopher because he had some influence at Vogue Patterns. My first job was actually on the same street that I work on now, on Fifth Avenue and 40th Street, top floor with all these ladies who came in from Vogue Patterns to design with their hats on, took their gloves off, had lunch 1 hour, came back. That was my first job. And we're talking about 1946, 47.
Okay. And for those listeners who don't know what Vogue Patterns was, can you explain the way it played a role in what women wore back in the day?
Well, thanks for asking that question. It played a big role because it was a sewing time. People did sew. The Singer sewing machines were very important. There were a number of pattern companies, but Vogue was the chicest one. Which I guess today you would say the same thing about the magazine. And in fact, I ended up doing Very Easy Vogue Patterns many years later. So the circle of my life kept coming back and biting me or feeding me. I don't know which it is. But that announcement solidified where I wanted to go. And I never veered from that. I went to college. I chose a school in the middle of the country in Cincinnati, Ohio, because I was afraid. I was playing with my sexuality at that point. I was unsure of myself. And I didn't want to go to New York quite yet. I wasn't ready for that. I chose a city that had a symphony orchestra because I was into classical music. And Cincinnati worked for me. It was a typical Midwestern city with it had an old German Jewish population. So I fit in very well. And my father was sort of proud of the fact that his son wanted to be a designer.
Let me pause you there for 1 second. When you said...
Push me anywhere.
Back to the point around sexuality. You know, what decade was this when you were going to college?
You're talking about the 40s and
50s. The 1940s and 50s. I mean, the world has really moved on and progressed since then. But if it's not too intrusive, I mean, what was it like to be struggling or playing with your sexuality at a time when things were so hidden and LGBTQ people were having to be like quite secretive about their identity?
The question's been asked of me before. And you know, when you look back, so many things are washed over. I'm amazed at how I was able to sort of balance where I was going. The sexual thing, I just assumed that my feeling toward men would disappear, that I would eventually marry, not even thinking twice about it. That would just happen. I'm the kind of guy that becomes president of everything I do. Even when I went to college, I became president of the fraternity. Of course, I was president of the CFDA. I'm president of all kinds of boards. I seem to have been able to, in my own way, plot my life. I assumed when it happened, and I came out in the Army, which was early 1950.
In the Army?
In the Army. I came out in the Army. And did I come out? Oh, my God. It's a very sweet story in the book about, I wasn't even sure at that point. I was a good soldier. I was the head of my little concern. Everybody wanted to be my friend. And I went to Dachau for classes on, I was at the Repo Depot in the Army, and I was their star speaker. When you came to Europe, you had to go through the Repo Depot, and I would teach Americans how to love the Germans and hate the Russians or be frightened of the Russians. But I had to go to Dachau. When I came home, there was a guy in the concern who looked at me and he said, "Where have you been all my life?" And that was the beginning of a journey. We were never sexually active together. He called me his sister. I never heard of such a thing, but I became his sister. And with him, I traveled into the bowels of, and there weren't bowels, of Europe, gay life. My first big affair was with this gentleman from Venice. We were told to come down and meet him and told to walk across the Piazza San Marco so that they could get if we were numbers or not. We passed muster, and this guy, Arthur Jeffers, became my first, in a sense, lover, this first person that wanted me to make love to, not just for my penis. He was a very interesting guy. So much so that when I wrote the book 70 years later, because he tried to make me stay in Europe so that we would, you know, I would end up with him in London. He had a gallery in London, by the way, and an art gallery. And it was the art gallery. His name was Arthur Jeffers. You can look him up. And I did, just as the book was being finished. And there was a book just came out about him. He was the most famous drag artist in all of Europe.
Wow.
And I was shocked that there he was 70 years later. He committed suicide because he was thrown out of Venice because he was a homosexual. And his gondoliers outed him after one night. He accused them of not bringing the Duke and Duchess of Windsor to home after her party at their house. So that's the kind of entrance I got into the gay world. Beautiful gondola guys rowing me around, a very handsome guy called himself my sister. And I thought to myself, well, God, heterosexual life isn't like this. I love it. And I never looked back. The thing about myself is when I left the Army, and I came to New York to work and ready to have sex with anybody that was available, I met the love of my life. And boom, and things changed.
Good for you. I mean, that took a lot of bravery, right, at that time, to be so bold and assertive and clear about who you were and not being afraid of all of the discrimination and challenge that comes with coming out at a time like that.
Well, you know, it's true, but I have to say about myself, remember, I was a designer. A designer is expected to be odd. My lover at the point, the love of my life, was a teacher, so it was a little different. And we had to be very protective of them. But we became the poster child. The Advocate did stories on us. We were a perfect couple and became very active. Certainly became very active when the AIDS epidemic slammed into us. I spent a lot of time raising lots of money, doing lots of fairs, having lots of parties in honor of it. But you know, when you write a book, you bring up little words about your life that you never knew were there, and you try to think of why they formed your life. I still can't tell you how and why. I just know this in retrospect. I've had such a good life because I think I've motivated toward good people.
Yeah.
I had few enemies, one or two. And then I put them into some sort of perspective. And I think meeting Gene made the big difference in my life. He was an intellect. I'm certainly not. He came from a well-read family. I did not. But I was a quick learner.
So, Stan, that gives us a really wonderful and good context of the person you were and the time you grew up in and the things that were shaping you and your sense of self at that time. How did you become a fashion designer? And how did you make the decision to do that?
It just seemed inevitable. I went to school, a school that had a fashion design department, the University of Cincinnati. It was my major. English was my minor. I don't know how that worked out. I also went to school. I won scholarships to school in New York. So I wanted to be a clothing designer. I was always a great sketcher. I think the concept weren't as good as the sketches when I look back at them. But when I first came to New York, again, I fell into a very rich brew of gays in New York, the movers and the shakers. I was cute.
You're still cute.
Even when Gene stopped everything, I seemed to find people. My first job was with an upscale house. And when you got that job, you met the right people. You weren't on the Broadway side of 7th Avenue. You were either at 530 or 550 7th Avenue or 498 7th Avenue. And somehow I got to know people right away. All became my friends. The Art Colony, I've been very close to people like Jerry Robbins, like Steve Sondheim, people who were the movers and shakers. And they just became a part of my life. Why? I don't know, but they did. I lived this life of a designer with an intellectual school teacher. And I plotted my life. I worked for 8 years in companies that I was first as third designer, second designer. I learned the hard way. Nothing happened quickly. That my closest friend at the time was Arnold Scazzi. Do you remember Arnold?
I don't know Arnold, no.
He was the first big American designer at the age of 22. He was like Marc Jacobs and Oscar de la Renta rolled into one. And he was my inspiration. He made it big. He said to me, "You're a terrible designer. You should learn how to design. You don't think about your clothes enough." And that's when I started to really look for the zeitgeist, think of what did I have something really to offer? And at times when things were bad, something always came about that made it work. By the end of the 50s, I was ready to go into the big time, having been an assistant designer for almost 8 years.
And how did that look, going the big time?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was the exact time when Yves Saint Laurent moved out to the world and stretched elbows. We all thought we were Yves Saint Laurent, all of us. I did my first collection alone, not with my name on it. It was called Junior Forum. Everybody, Women's Wear Daily said, "My God, this guy's, he's a genius. He's the next big star." And it's very funny. I had this brief moment where I wanted to be in show business at the end of that 8-year period where I was apprenticing everywhere. I kept saying to Gene, "Give me a year. I want to be a star. Give me just 1 year." He said, "Okay, I'll give you a year." So within a year, I was on Broadway. I had second lead in a Broadway show. Couldn't sing well, could sort of move. And while I was in the show on Broadway, the guy said to me, "I'll teach you how to sing if you really don't want to sing for 2 years, if you don't sing professionally." And I did. I developed an operatic voice. It was really quite astounding. My coach was Pavarotti's coach.
Oh, wow.
And so at that point, leaving, trying to be in show business, and suddenly became very successful on 7th Avenue, 7th Avenue won out.
And so at some point, you did set up your own label called Mr. Mort, right? When did that happen?
Yes.
And what was the reason for like setting it up? And where does that name come from?
It came from a guy, the name comes from a man named Mort Goldman, who, like many people in the Garment Center, had a vision about fashion at a price. He fucked up the business very quickly and lost it in auction to another gentleman. Before I got there, it was the young business. It was Ann Klein and Mr. Mort. Those were the two. And I had done this other collection that the Women's Wear loved so very much that the Mr. Mort people called me and said, would you be interested in coming over to us? And unbeknownst to me, my other collection was being backed by the mafia. And they closed it down. So there was I just moved on over to Mr. Mort. So it was a company that I moved into, actually into the third room. I ended up being president of it, which is very unusual. It was a big company. And the clothes were young. The fit was smaller. It was a whole revolution. It was the first young designer revolution, which Ann Klein would be the head of. Liz Claiborne would be that kind of Mr. Mort. It was equivalent to the young designer movement that we have every so often now. And very successful. Mr. Mort became hot, 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 hot.
What was the key item that Mr. Mort was known for? Was there a specific style or silhouette or?
Clean, almost virginal, sexy lines. I loved covered up, sexy clothes. Lots of pleats, lots of movement. The fit was what it was. I had a great assistant. Sometimes I wonder if she was really better than me. Her name was Barbara Larson. We had 10 years of just glory. Everybody wanted to be on the train with me. But what happens, we sold the business to a large company called Rustogs, and the bottom line became the most important thing. And where we were being deified by the press, we were being slashed to pieces by the bottom line. And finally, Rustog called a halt to it. There's a great film called Schmata that was done, and it's all about that and how they closed me down. And after they closed me down, that's the end of the 60s now. 60s was my decade. It was that do your own thing, Vietnam War. I wore bells around my neck so I could be heard everywhere. I talked too much. I said things when I read the things I say, how the fuck did I ever say that? But my pals were Ralph and Calvin. And when it closed, my life changed. I became a freelance designer. And to this day, that's what I do. I had my own studio. My assistant at that time was a wonderful gentleman named Bill Robinson, who had a big menswear career eventually. And I've bitten off, as I call, the edges of the pie for the last 40 years, but the edges have been very rich. I mean, I had such a good home life. I couldn't wait to get home. Unfortunately, Gene died after we were together 40 years. And not that everything was perfect, but it was perfect. And at that moment, after the year that Gene died, he was trying to convince me to retire. I was in my early 60s. I wasn't ready to retire. But if push came to shove, I thought I would do that for him. His writing career had sort of reached a strange place. He was writing gay books that weren't being published, and gay publishing was just taking off. He was unsure why that was happening. His last book was called Privates, very good book about the underground army, gay underground in the army, which was a very good book. But he died of a heart attack in one day.
I'm sorry.
My life changed. But what happened, Imran, was that the CFDA had just pulled me out of nowhere and made me their president.
We'll be right back with more on the BOF podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say, eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you feel like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. When it comes to style and luxury, eBay gets it. They're making sure the things you love are checked by experts. And not just any experts, specialized experts. Real people who love this stuff, with real, hands-on authentication experience. So when you see that shiny blue checkmark that says Authenticity Guarantee, shop with confidence. Every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is verified authentic through a detailed inspection. That's how you know that eBay's got your back. Because when you finally step into those sneakers, put on that watch, get your real gold glow up, swing that handbag over your shoulder, or step out in that streetwear, you'll realize that feeling is unlike any other. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? For me, I got a chef-grade range recently, and now I'm cooking new things every single night. Seriously, no cuisine is off limits. The point is, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. I can picture myself with a car full of groceries, cruising down the highway, soaking up the sun with the available dynamic sky panorama glass roof. Ugh, pure bliss. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
You said you became the president of everything. So that happened in fashion too.
Yeah.
And so when you moved into the CFDA as the president, just paint a picture for us, for those of us who weren't around or haven't done our homework. What was going on in American fashion at that time? You've mentioned already some of these legendary names like Calvin Klein and Ralph Lauren and Anne Klein, and I guess Donna Karan was coming around. Like, what was going on in American fashion at that moment, and what was it contributing to global fashion?
Well, I mean, you always have to think about the triumvirate, the three, Donna, Calvin, and Ralph. They changed American fashion. Sportswear changed American fashion. Nothing but sportswear. To me, I've always said that Anne Klein changed it. She came up to me in the 50s and said, I'm going to do sportswear. I'm going to do parts and pieces, tops and bottoms. I'm not going to do one-piece things anymore. It's ridiculous. And when America became sportswear capital of the world, everything changed. The Council of Fashion Designers of America was a club. It was a private club in the very beginning, in the 60s. I was not allowed in it in the beginning because my clothes were too inexpensive. It was controlled by, you know, it was the Norels and the Trigers and the Raggies and the Beans and the Blass and Bill Blass. But it was more like a club, and everybody wanted to be in it. And if you're good enough, you were asked. But you never did anything. We had a gala every year, which was with the Met, and the money went back to the Met. So there really wasn't even a treasury. When Caroline Rome threw up her hands, we had just raised $5 million for AIDS on sale. And it became too much for her. The whole thing became too much for her. She was our president. I had been put on the board by Perry Ellis. Perry doesn't know it, but he changed my life completely. If he hadn't put me on the board, I would never have become president. And when I became president, I thought, well, 2 years, I'll do it until we find a new place. But I was so right for the time, and the time was so right for me. Oscar wasn't too happy about it. It was his private club for a long, long, long time. In fact, Oscar's the only person that I had a difficult time with during all of my years there. We made peace with each other before he died, but it was not the greatest relationship that we had. It was his organization, and it became mine. And it was mine for 16 years. That's a long time.
Over those 16 years, how did you change it from being a kind of exclusive club for the fashion elite to something that was more open or more with more of a sense of real purpose and goals as like a professional organization?
It just seemed like such an obvious thing that there were so many people who wanted in, who should have been in. And then, of course, I hired Fern, who was a mover and shaker with the whole thing. I use her moving and shaking the right way. She made a lot of the moves, and I sort of stayed in the background and watched it happen. Controlled it in my way, but watched it happen. We opened up the awards gala. We decided we went to Lincoln Center. We had our distractors, but we decided to make it more egalitarian. We wanted more people in it, and we wanted to see what they had to do. We rediscovered all the accessory people, and I was hands-on. You could call me any time of day. It don't have to be Ralph Lauren to call me. You could be Oscar nobody. It was that kind of thing. I just loved doing it.
Yeah.
I had the time to do it. I was in business, and also I was not a competitor with my friends. I didn't compete with Bill. I didn't compete with Oscar. So they let me do it. Many times I said, you know, my tie should be up. There was a point where I asked Calvin, would you like to be president? No, I don't want to be president. You're doing a perfect job. Donna, the same thing. And so the 16 years just clicked off. It just clicked off. At the end, it was time. I probably should have gone a year before I left. I went through, of course, other executive directors. Again, as a non-paying performer, I spent a lot of time working there. I was there almost every day at the office to see how things were going. It was very hands-on. It was a different time.
You made the quite pivotal decision to set up those tents in Bryant Park, which became such a moment for fashion in New York. I mean, that's my first fashion shows that I used to break into.
Really?
Yeah, I had to sneak into those shows, and like, I wasn't on any list. And so my friend Jamil and I found a way of like breaking through multiple layers of security. But I just remember when I was first exploring fashion, and by the way, I broke into the Diane von Furstenberg show. I broke into the Zach Posen show. I mean, those were like very important shows at the time.
Very, very.
And I just remember there was such an energy around New York Fashion Week because it was so much of it was happening in the same place, right in the center of Manhattan. And that was your decision. You know, that was a big move.
Yes, it was. And you know, my studio overlooks Bryant Park. It still does to this very day. I don't even know if I can say it, but in 2 weeks from now, there's going to be a bench in my honor and Fern's honor, which will be inaugurated in the park. So that park has become, for me, my life in New York. I'm a very big joiner of things. I'm on the Community Board 5 in Midtown Manhattan. I'm the head of new construction at one point, the head of Parks Department at the other point. So the park has lived with me. I'm very political in the sense that we have business improvement districts. I'm on two of them, Bryant Park. But those are a part of my job, as I felt, as president of the CFDA. But what happened was when we decided to go to raise the shows, I looked down from my studio. I said, this is the perfect place for it. In the beginning, they wouldn't give us the lawn because there are stacks from the library underneath, and they were afraid of the pressure. But once we got in it and got over the bar mitzvah tents that we had in the very first 2 years, the tents became quite extraordinary. And if probably, you know, on my gravestone, that's probably the most important thing that I did in fashion. It's still known as Fashion Park. It's never been the same since it left Bryant Park, but that's okay. Things do change. We've lost that cohesiveness now. Big business tends to do that. We were in a Judy Garland movie for a long time, but then we had to grow up.
Hmm. Well, it leads me to my next question, which is, you're still designing and working today and doing a bunch of stuff with QVC. But I'm just curious, as someone watching from the outside a little bit now, when you look at what the fashion industry has become, how big it's become, how much of a business it's become, what are your reflections on that, the way fashion is today?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. The fact that it's become such hot business with so much money being floated out there, it's changed the whole nature of the business. The body shape has changed. When I came in the 40s and 50s, it was a mom and pop organization. America was, we had our factories, then people made money. A designer could make a good living. But once we anointed designers as superstars, once big business and Wall Street put their cashmere gloves on, fashion is not the same. It just is not the same. The talent is still there. There's so little time to nurture that talent. But I think the talent is almost even better. I mean, some of these kids are just extraordinary. They just lose sight of where they're going because it's so competitive and the results can be so up and down. I like clothes today. So much crap. It's true, but so much of it is very good. Right now we're thinking of you know, who's going to be the designer of the year, or the international designer of the year. And that there are lots of good people out there.
So are you still involved with the CFDA?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay.
I'm a heavy hitter from backstage, yes. I'm on the board of the CFDA. Stephen calls me an awful lot. I think Diane and I are the only two people left over from that era, although I'm a little older than Diane. And even the council is going through big changes. I think in the next year or two, you'll see major changes because the business is changing. It's definitely changing. And we reflect that. We definitely reflect that. In my life, what's so wonderful for me is that my uniform business is still terrific. I signed another contract with FedEx. 45 years I've been doing FedEx's uniform.
Wow.
And it's been a labor of love. Michael and I are doing all the Sandal hotels down in the Caribbean at this point. I do JetBlue. We just did the Central Park. So I'm still involved. I can't believe I'm as old as I am, although this morning I felt it.
What keeps you moving and going and so active and purposeful at this age of almost 96?
I don't know. I sound sometimes self-serving. I don't mean this self-serving. I've had such a good life. Lucky to find the love of my life. Lucky to find a business that I can make a living in. Lucky that I could find people who are not the average to settle in with. So I'm a happy camper that way. I hate being old in the morning, but I live with it. I work it. And I've got good people around me. I've never been motivated toward more people. I've never had terrible breakups, blah, 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 blah. I just haven't. And I have a family. My brother's still alive. Both of my brothers are still alive. My father lived to be 105. Rode horses until he was 90. I'm definitely his clone. There's no doubt about that. After we finish this interview, I'll clop myself into bed. Who knows? Well,
I hope I didn't exhaust you.
No, you didn't. What it does is it makes you feel you have to do something. We just did a book tour in Dallas, and I thought, I'll never get through this. The second the spotlight hits you, you know what showbiz is.
I do. Talk to me a little bit about this book, because you've mentioned it a few times, but I read somewhere that you had thought about writing a book and you'd put pen to paper at some stage, and then that first go at doing the book, it didn't work. What happened the second time around? Like, what changed?
The pandemic. What happened was I had the time to sit down in my house in the country without people. The first book was right after Gene died. And everybody expected me. When I was new president of the CFDA, I expected me to tell dirt on everybody. And I didn't know how to do that. I really didn't know how to do that. And I gave it to an agent. It wasn't going to get published. So I put it away. When the pandemic hit, I sat in my big leather chair out in the country and I started to write. And it just started. It sounds like Pollyanna in the beginning, and it just flowed. I wrote everything. I wrote it. I mean, nobody else wrote it. I write longhand, which is very tricky because I have to have somebody put it into the computer. And to see the longhand turn into the computer is a very strange thing. And then it became, the title, which is everybody loves. You know why the title is.
Yeah, Uncross Your Legs.
But most people don't know why that is the title. I mean, that's what the photographers scream right at the front row people. And it's become a great title because people pick it up in the bookstore. Oh, what is that? What is that? Guy Trebe was very upset with me because he wrote a book called Uncross Your Legs. He couldn't use the title.
Oh, you got to it before Guy did. So in the process of writing the book, Stan, did you realize or learn or reflect on things that hadn't occurred to you before? Like, was the process of writing the book cathartic?
Very much so. That sounds obvious, but it really was. Again, as I said in the beginning, I rediscovered my mother.
Yeah.
I rediscovered why I fell in love with Gene, with all the odds against me and against him. I began to know why I wanted to, a little bit why I wanted to still work. Everybody says they've got a book in them. My brother, who loves to compete with me, just finished his book. But I had a book in me, and it came out easily and flowed nicely. And when I read it today, and I, you know, in my readings, I'm very happy with the way people react to it. They move into the book. They seem to be a part of it in a very real way. It's not a fashion book in the sense, it's just a lifestyle book. I think it has legs. We'll see. It's going into a second printing, which is very nice to hear.
Congratulations. So having written the book, having reflected on your life, having realized those things that maybe you had buried away or discovered, do you have any regrets now looking back?
Well, I do. I mean, the obvious ones, I wish Gene had been here longer. That he would have been so proud of me. I actually sat down and did this. I'm a very good sketcher. I don't know if you've seen the book, but I'm really a good sketcher. Probably better sketcher than writer. But my next book will be all these sketches with just little vignettes about my life. If I have any regrets, they're very little. I have no regrets.
So for all the people listening, and by the way, this podcast reaches people all around the world in like 170 countries.
Wow.
It's very rare that someone like me gets to learn from someone like you who's, you know, lived to the age of 96. Like, what's the secret, do you think, for living a fulfilling and rich life like the one that you've led?
Well, first of all, you have to have the genes to live this long.
Of course,
that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to have the genes. And I do have the genes, there's no doubt. Even though my mother died at a very young age, I think she left lots of good spots in me. If I had an answer, I would be the Wunderkind. I don't think we talked about it. One of the most important things in my life has been music. It's been life fulfilling for me. But I'm talking about classical music. I like all music, but classical music. And it's been very life fulfilling for me. It sort of represents how I feel about life, period. I conduct in my car every day around the country. I have breakfast or I have lunch and listening to a Mahler symphony and conducting in the car and thinking I'm in the Alps with him walking around, or I'm with Kirill Petrenko in Berlin Philharmonic. Those are real things that I do every day. And I think that's what keeps me going. Tomorrow night, I'm going to see a soprano I've been waiting 10 years to see. I mean, just the idea that I haven't seen her yet. Those things add up. And I think what they do is they give you length in life. You don't put periods too often. I just do da, 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 and continue. Da, 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 and continue.
That's a wonderful place to end. Thank you so much, Stan, for sharing.
Thank you.
With me.
It's a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. I'm going to cry now.
So am I. Thank you very much. I hope you have a lovely day, and I hope you enjoy that very, very well-deserved nap after this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you.
The BOF podcast is edited and produced by Emma Clark, Olivia Davies, and Eric Bria.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? For me, I got a chef-grade range recently, and now I'm cooking new things every single night. Seriously, no cuisine is off limits. The point is, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. I can picture myself with a car full of groceries, cruising down the highway, soaking up the sun with the available dynamic sky panorama glass roof. Ugh, pure bliss. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.